Hi, everybody, and welcome back to this week's episode of the podcast and my interview with Danielle LaSouza. This week, Danielle tells a story that might be triggering for some of you. Specifically, it's about what happened after the birth of her baby and how she found herself suffering from postpartum psychosis. So for those of you who are sensitive to this subject or to anything around mental health, please take care. We talk a bit about doors in this episode and how giving birth is really this intensely liminal space where the soul meets the body and enters it for its journey on earth. When I lived in Portland, I had a healer who I became very good friends with, and she told me how she had attended the birth of her sister's baby and how at the moment of birth, she saw this door open, this kind of portal, and she witnessed the baby's soul come forth and enter the baby's body. It was so groundbreaking and stunning for her that it was all she could talk about for the next few months. And all this to say, we don't really know, do we? Is there a soul? Isn't there? Is it up in our heads, our hearts? Is it in our whole bodies? Where do souls come from? Sylvia Plath, from her collected poems, said, "I am terrified by this dark thing that sleeps in me. And that dark thing, our soul, is the dreamer of our dreams, the architect of our hopes and the self. It is us." I'm not going to lie, this conversation about the soul is a big one, but maybe you could think about it this week, about your soul and what and how it's speaking to you. Despite these big questions, we do have a podcast episode to get to, and Danielle's powerful story of liminal spaces and how, if the door is left just a bit open, potentials and mystery abound.
You know, it's funny. I was in New York at the time, the first part of my pregnancy. My husband had gotten a job. I was teaching in New York. I had to finish out my school year. So we spent the first half of my pregnancy on separate coasts. And I remember talking to my therapist, getting ready to move, and saying, you know, I'm going to be moving to a new city where I don't know anybody. And my husband's going to be working, you know, 5 days a week. And I will be by myself with a new baby in a one-bedroom apartment. It sounds like a recipe for a nervous breakdown.
But it's who are you as a human being? If you were to go to a party or a conference and you had to introduce yourself and self-describe, how would you do that? Who are you?
Yeah, I read that in your list of questions and I thought, oh, well, there's so many different ways I could answer this question, I think, as many of us could. But I think, you know, generally, the markers that I highlight when I talk to people are things like, I'm a mother, I'm a philosopher. I am now a philosopher for hire. I'm a philosopher by training and by trade. So I have a PhD in philosophy and I use that to coach people in making, you know, good decisions for their lives. And I specialize in helping new and expectant moms grapple with what it means to make a human being, which is no small thing that we do. And yeah, I'm from the Midwest. I've lived all over. I lived on the East Coast for about 10 years. I've lived here in the Pacific Northwest for eight years now. And I love dancing and moving around physically, and dancing in particular, doing yoga, cooking, hiking. Those things help kind of balance out my much more heady intellectual side of me. So yeah, I think that that's sort of a short answer to your question.
You sound like you have an adventurous spirit. Would you say that's true?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It's funny. I never really thought of myself that way when I was a kid. I always thought I was kind of a homebody and, you know, liked the comforts of being in my little nest with my family. But to my own surprise, I feel like I've actually done a lot of things. I've moved very far away from home, and yeah, done a lot of things that I never really imagined I would do when I was younger.
Yeah, because, you know, just uprooting yourself and moving to such different places takes gumption. It takes, like, you know, because you're essentially almost recreating your life from the beginning, because you land somewhere, you know, maybe you would have friends, like when you moved to Portland, maybe you had some friends there, but truly when you land somewhere like that, you have to recreate kind of you, and it's an incredible opportunity to recreate the self, right? Or the self that you show the world, which is kind of exciting. And so I, you know, it's also stressful to move.
Oh my gosh. And it takes, yeah, it takes a long time, I think, to feel settled in a new place and to feel like it's home. I spent a lot of years, particularly the years between Philadelphia and Portland, really looking for a sense of home, and feeling a little unsettled. New York City is not exactly a place where you can kind of settle into. I lived there for a while, and I had colleagues who I asked, they'd been there, you know, 8, 9, 10 years. And I said, when did New York start to feel like home for you? And they said, oh, it still doesn't. So at that point I was like, maybe I should, you know, leave.
This is just a side note, but I have to tell you, one of the most charming and enchanting books I've ever read, which was so subversive for me, is Sophie's World.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't read it.
It is. I mean, I was like, what? This book is incredible. And I'm being taught things. And I don't even know how this is happening, but it's happening. And, you know, I can have years in between reading Sophie's World. And I, every time I go back, it's fresh, probably because I'm going through menopause and I can't remember anything. But it is a glorious, glorious book that elucidates and beautifully just, I think helps, because it's so easy to understand all these different philosophies. And I just, I don't know, when I picked it up at Powell's, used book, I was like, oh, what is this? This looks interesting. I mean, I'll check it out. I'll try it. And then I opened it and I was instantly just engrossed with the story, with learning, with appreciating all of these ways of being and thinking that I hadn't understood before. And so I guess one of my questions for you would be, how did you get drawn to philosophy?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. How did I get drawn to philosophy? Well, I went to college. I was raised in an evangelical Christian household, non-denominational, but we went to like a big church with, you know, jumbo screens and no, like closed circuit TV and like the nosebleed section and 20 piece band on stage. And I kind of grew up going to that church, you know, on Sundays when I was younger, and then kind of on Christmas and Easter when I got older. And I wanted to become a better Christian as I was getting ready to go off to college. And I was like, I told myself I needed to like read my Bible more and double down on my Christian faith and be a better person and more pious and more faithful. And then I went to college and I took a course. My first philosophy class was an ethics honor seminar called Who's to Judge? And it wasn't even my first choice, but it was the one I got put in. And that class blew my mind. It just blew my mind. It made me, for the very first time, it made me think about the fact that I could have a moral structure outside of religion, that you didn't need to believe in God to believe in good. And that was really kind of, it was just something I'd never considered before. And so we went through this class, and it really made me question all the things that I thought I believed. And we did, you know, a section on abortion, you know, ethical issues, abortion and homosexuality and the death penalty. And I realized that I didn't actually have my own opinions about these things. In the past, I'd always just kind of consulted my Bible, and whatever my Bible told me was right was the right answer. And I had a roommate. Well, she was kind of down the hall from me, who was in my same class, and she was raised Unitarian Universalist. And she had just had clearly given much more thought to these questions, and her convictions and her beliefs felt much more genuine to her own, you know, system. And it just made me realize, like, oh, I actually haven't done the work of knowing why I believe what I believe and if I even believe it. And so my religious structure started to kind of crumble around me. And by the time my freshman year was over, I mean, my spring semester, I took a class on Friedrich Nietzsche and then a class on Indian philosophy. And that was just it. I stopped believing. And I felt like it was this really... it felt like freedom. It felt like I was coming out from underwater for the first time. And I started to feel like I could have my own sense of self, my own beliefs, my own worldview. And it made me want to do that for other people and give that experience to other people and teach them not what to believe or what to think, but how to think and how to figure out what they believe for themselves. And so that was it for me.
I love that. That's so beautiful. I don't know how much you read about me, but I grew up overseas. And so I'll always be kind of informed by the Islamic world because I spent 4 years over there. And it was just so, you know, everything from how they worshiped all day to the art, to the architecture. It's just such a glorious, to be surrounded by that much beauty all the time really is very powerful, especially for a kid, you know, just, you just soak it all in. And I think, you know, I please forgive me. I am so ignorant about philosophy. You know, I used to think I was a Stoic for a while, but now I'm kind of just very drawn to beauty and not necessarily hedonism, but just how to be deeply in the world in a hedonistic way, in a way that you're like saturated, like you and the world are meeting each other, meeting at the same place and deeply invested in the world and this, and appreciating the beauty, whether it's exchange with a stranger or someone's painting or making it through a spin class, which I haven't done yet, or whatever that looks like. But that's where I'm at just right now. Is that fall into any of the philosophical realms? Probably. You would know.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because, you know, I have studied kind of canonical Western white old dead man philosophy. And, you know, I have like a part of my areas of competence is Eastern philosophy, particularly Buddhism. I know a lot about Buddhism and I've taught Buddhism and a little bit of Hinduism as the origins of Buddhism, and a little bit of Chinese philosophy. But I think that there is, you know, there are different philosophers who have a lot to say about the body and the way in which the body is connected to the world, connected to the mind, connected to our senses of ourselves and our experience. I think for most of Western history, there is this kind of like distinction and animosity. You know, this Cartesian, like Descartes said, there's the body and there's the brain and they're two separate things. We have our mind and our mind can exist without our bodies. And Descartes' argument was essentially like, all I know is that I am a thinking thing, right? I think, therefore I am. So I'm a thinking thing, so I must exist. And then he said, but I have this experience of having a body and like seeing myself in the world. And I don't know if that's real or not. All I know is that I am real. But because I also have this idea of God and I believe that God wouldn't lie to me, I'm going to, you know, accept that my body is real and that the world is real. But there's, you know, a lot of people have said like, that's not actually, if you don't believe in God, that's not a super satisfying answer. But I think like the rupture, the assumption that you could separate the mind from the body is a very kind of Western idea. And Descartes wasn't the first one who said that. I mean, it goes all the way back, you know, to the Greeks, who, you know, Socrates said that the soul is the prisoner of the body, and or the body is the prison of the soul. And so, you know, it's like that kind of way of conceiving. And of course, Christianity obviously also has that kind of conception, right? There are bodies which are bad and to be tamed and to be disciplined and to be regulated. And the soul is where the pure, you know, true self is. I think the idea that there, that the body and the engagement with the world is a deeply valuable part of the human experience is a kind of non-patriarchal, non-Western, or, you know, at least challenges some of those ideas. Because women in the past, you know, have been deeply associated with the body. And if the body is devalued, then like, great, we could just take care of that problem. And I think, you know, especially in becoming a mother, part of what I have experienced and part of what my philosophical work has been in the last 8 years since I've become a mother is just a revaluation of the body and my experience with it as a source of wisdom. Not as something to be dominated or disciplined or controlled, but actually as an important part of what it means to be human. And that I think that Western philosophy has ignored this is actually a real detriment to the discipline. It just like, it's obviously a detriment to women, but it's also, it means that we just don't have a full understanding of the human experience within that intellectual Western tradition. And that's a shame. It's a real shame.
May I ask, if this isn't too personal, just what are, you know, two philosophical avenues that really speak to you?
Yeah, I wrote my dissertation about Jean-Paul Sartre, who is a Western existential philosopher. And existentialism has always kind of appealed to me. And that's like, you know, it's a big fancy word, but it means, you know, different existentialists have said different things. But I think some of the parts of existentialism that appeal to me is the idea that like, look, we kind of show up here as human beings. We're born and it's up to us to decide what our lives mean. You know, we tell stories about what our world is or should be, or what our experiences mean to us. And those are things that we can always change. We have this like incredible human ability to revise and retell and reimagine ourselves in our world. And I think there's something really powerful about that. So existential philosophy has been kind of one route. It's funny, when I talk to clients, I give them a little overview of my philosophical influences. So maybe I'll give you the three that I give clients instead of just two. So existential philosophy. The second one is Buddhist philosophy, as I said. And I've done a lot of meditating over the last 10 years in particular. And I've taught Buddhism for, you know, 20 years. So I know a lot about it. And I find that to be just like, maybe because it's so different from that Western intellectual tradition, it really appeals to me. It does not draw a distinction between the mind and body in the same way. It sort of understands that they are interconnected, and it has a kind of monistic, you know, unity at the bottom of everything. We're all connected. There is no distinction between world and mind, or you and me, or, you know, earth and heaven. It just, it's all one. And to me, that is really attractive. And then the third school of thought is feminist philosophy. And for me, that is really broadly construed to mean that we don't, you know, it's not only do we experience oppression along the lines of gender, but also race, class, ethnicity, sexuality, and that those things really matter, right? Like where we exist in the world and the kinds of social structures that are in place impact our experience of who we are, of what matters, of how we think, what we see, what we think's important, you know, what we value. And that if we're going to talk to people, we need to take those things into consideration. I think philosophy has had this habit of saying that we know things in this kind of God's eye view from nowhere, when really that God's eye view from nowhere is just like a rich white guy's point of view.
I would love to just pick your brain about this, but you know, I'm huge science nerd, and recently, within the last 2 years, they've pretty definitively proved that photosynthesis is a quantum operation. Just based on the measurements they've made. And then Popular Mechanics just came out with an article, which I found to be thoroughly fascinating and exciting, because, you know, everybody's always arguing about what consciousness is, for the love of God. Mm-hmm. And they're reviving this old theory that consciousness, I mean, the title of the article is fabulous. And it's basically like, scientists are close to cracking what consciousness is, something like, hint, you're connected to the entire universe. And so they're positing that consciousness is a quantum operation. And they're doing all these studies with these microtubules in the brain. And it's not definitive yet, but it makes sense. And it also explains a lot of things that happen that are, you know, supranormal events that people can't explain and what have you. But, you know, going back to Einstein's, you know, where everything's connected and particles can affect each other, spooky action at a distance, you know, and different. So, you know, if they do in fact discover that consciousness is a quantum property and that each of us is actually connected, that we're this whole, really, that consciousness is this whole thing. And there's a field, they think, where possibilities lie and, you know, things can pop in and out of existence that our consciousness can be privy to, because it's also in the realm of energy and vibration. Like, what do you think that would do to philosophy? Do you, I know that's, it's like kind of a big question, but I'm just curious.
Well, I guess I have a question for you. And what do you mean when you say, consciousness is a quantum, function? Like, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, what they were positing in the article was that, you know, there's basically this field everywhere, and that consciousness is outside of us, and that we, but not only that, it's like kind of everywhere, all around us at all times. And well, you were speaking of Buddhism earlier. Mm-hmm. And I heard some of that language and like the unity and the, you know, accessibility. And I guess I would say even egalitarianism of that is, I really, that it really appeals to me a lot, but it's like something that is, outside of us, that we, that functions in our brain, like a wave function or a particle, and that we can reach out and, we're not separate, that we're all like swimming in this sea of energy. And, you know, it explains, like, for example, if you think of someone during the day, and then that person ends up calling you that night. Mm-hmm. Just that we're all connected. Like, division, us being separate beings, is an illusion.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's sort of what the like law of attraction manifesty people have been saying, right? Like, we're all, thoughts become things, and you just need to tap into the universal consciousness, and you know, you'll get $1 million. And like that, all that stuff interests me. And certainly if there's like some way of, for kind of Western science to talk about that and line up with it, great. Like, that, I think that's interesting. I do think when the philosophy of consciousness is not exactly my area of expertise, but certainly different philosophers have a lot of different ways of talking about it. But so many of them rely on a kind of individualistic, you know, premise, right? That we are all distinct people. And you know, typically the way that philosophers talk about consciousness is like, okay, well, there's consciousness as a separate kind of substance, right? Like, maybe it's a separate kind of substance, which is, I guess, sort of aligned with what you're saying, but, you know, whether or not that substance is unified, I think, is another question, right? Is there like a soul that is distinct, or is it a kind of like collective soul, as it were, that we all just kind of like tune into, like tuning into a TV show or a radio station? But the other way of talking about it is that consciousness is an emergent quality, right? That like there's the, then this is sort of the materialist point of view that we're all separate, distinct people. And we have brains and we've got all these neurons and, you know, gray matter in our brains, and they're all just doing what they do. And we, you know, thoughts are essentially, some people say consciousness is just a metaphor for lots of the synapses firing in your brain. It's not actually a real thing. It's not substantive in any way. It's simply a shorthand because we don't know all of the mechanical stuff that's happening. But really, when you come down to it, it's all mechanics. And then there's some people who think that it's somewhere between those two, that like consciousness is perhaps, maybe it's not a substance, but it emerges from the right conditions, the right mechanical conditions. And there is something that is greater than the sum of its parts, right? It's not just the brain. It's greater than the sum of its parts, but it's not necessarily a separate substance either. But none of them, I mean, there may be philosophers that I don't know off of the top of my head who talk about a kind of, I mean, Jung kind of talked about a collective unconscious, but I think for that, he was really kind of talking more in a metaphorical way, but I don't know. I haven't read that much Jung. So, I don't know. I mean, sure. I think it's the Buddhists, again, don't distinguish between mind and body. And so for them, it's like, well, of course we're all one. Like, I think the way that I talk about it with students when I used to teach in a university was like the self or consciousness is sort of like a fire that when you have the right conditions, when you have, you know, oxygen and something to light it and something to burn, it gives rise to flame. But flame isn't like a thing. It is just dependent upon the conditions. And fire can spread and it can join up with other fires. And it is not, you know, like, but I don't know. It's a question that I don't have the answer to. And I think that traditionally Western philosophers don't take very seriously this idea of, you know, the law of attraction kind of version of this historically, but that might be changing. I don't know. I'm kind of out of academic philosophy now. I'm not super plugged into it anymore, but I'd be curious.
Getting just down to practical matters, I have an insane fear of public speaking. So I have to tell you that when I saw you did a TED talk, I was like, oh my God, I want to pick her brain. Like, how did that happen? And how did you have the guts to do it?
Well, it's funny. I've been kind of like on self-imposed book writing hermitage for the last year and a half, and I'm just starting to emerge now. And so talking to you is part of that, but I've just in the last couple of days been thinking about how I would really love to do more public speaking because it's something that I really enjoy and I feel pretty competent in. So talking about this kind of manifesting stuff, several years ago, I mean, I had wanted to do a TEDx talk forever. Like, it was just, as soon as I learned what a TED talk was, I was like, oh, I want to do one of those, right? Because part of my goal has always been, like, I want philosophy not to be stuck in the halls of academia. I feel like philosophy should come to the people, and it's there to transform the lives of real human beings. And I think that we should be able to talk to real people about philosophy in language that they can understand and not like do this weird macho, like whoever can speak in more obscure terms is smarter. So I've always wanted to be a kind of public intellectual. And for me, a TED talk is like the perfect vehicle for that. So I'd wanted to do one for a while, and I'd had friends who, you know, I started meeting more and more people who had done one. And I was like, oh, one of these days, maybe someday I would love to do that. And then one year, it was like January, I don't know, 2018, maybe. I just had this moment where I was like, I'm going to do one. And I'm going to do a TED talk, and I'm going to do one, and it's going to happen sometime in the next 2 years. I'm going to do it. I just like made the decision that it was going to happen. And I was teaching at Portland Community College at the time. And literally the next day, I went into the teacher's lounge and there was a flyer for like TEDxPCC. And it was, you know, come, you know, be a part of TEDxPCC. Like, we're looking for people to help produce whatever. So I emailed the, like, in the past, I know I would have looked at that and been like, oh, someday I'll do that, you know. But because I had the day before, I was like, I'm going to do this. I saw it and I like sent an email being like, hey, I want to be involved in this. And I got an email back saying like, oh, well, you know, we're doing kind of just production stuff now. But if you want to be a speaker, like there's going to be, you know, applications will be open in a month or whatever. Here's the link. So then I applied and then I got selected and then I was on my way.
Was it nerve-wracking at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and luckily, I mean, you know, they did a really great job. Like they paired us with a speech professor, like someone who specializes in public speaking. And that person helped us kind of craft our talks and practice. And there were a lot of rehearsals and, you know, very rigorous rehearsal schedule. And, but I was here for it because it was just something that I had, like I said, it had been this dream of mine. And, yeah, I'm really glad that I got the opportunity to do it.
Whatever you'd like to share, I'm like here for. I've heard it all. Just putting it out there. So
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll see if you've heard mine. Mine's kind of a big story. So yeah, when I saw that was, you know, kind of what you focus on, the big thing that comes to mind for me was when my daughter was about 3 months old. I have one child. And when I was about 3 months postpartum, I was hospitalized with postpartum psychosis. And that was, you know, I was in the hospital for about a week, 5 days. And then I was in an outpatient program for about a month and a half after that. And that was a really terrifying part, you know, experience of my life. And I wouldn't recommend it. But at the same time, there was a lot of magic in it. And yeah, it's hard to even really, I'm writing a book about it now, trying to parse it all apart for myself. But there certainly was something about it that I felt like was not simply mental illness, but I really did feel like I kind of tapped into something true. And part of that is because before I went, you know, I went through that experience, I had done a few years of pretty intensive meditation. And I'd gone on these retreats, these 10-day silent retreats, and had experiences there that were really intense, like felt kind of psychedelic in nature. And that really kind of informed my experience of chronic sleep deprivation and the feeling of being kind of high and manic and, you know, feeling like I was having a very similar experience of being in an elevated state, you know, and perhaps in a different spiritual state. And I think that, you know, as I like say these things, it feels like, okay, well, you know, again, different people tell different stories about what these things mean. I think that the story I was getting from my medical professionals was like, this is delusion. You are ill. This is, you know, you need medication. You need to sleep more. And some of those things were true. But at the same time, I don't think that what I experienced was entirely delusion or false. And I think that I had experiences. You know, like, for example, the fact that I could see things and people and the colors would feel totally saturated and there was a kind of energy and a kind of like everything sort of sparkled, you know, and then I would like sleep for a few hours and wake up and it would feel totally normal again and different. And I just think it's weird that the human brain is so malleable. And it just made me think a lot about how different people experience the world in different ways. I felt like I had different perceptual experiences that I normally would not have. And it made me wonder who else is having perceptual experiences like mine, but they've they're acclimated to it. So it doesn't feel dangerous or weird or new to them. It just is the way they see the world. And it just made me wonder, like, well, what does that mean about truth? And what does it mean about, you know, human consciousness? It just, it, as a philosopher and going through that experience, I had a lot of thoughts.
That's kind of an astonishing story. And I, you know, every mother to be is different, of course. And I'm going to assume, and please tell me if I'm wrong, that when you were getting ready to have your baby, that you weren't planning on this happening.
Correct. Yes.
Was it even like, could you even conceive of it happening?
You know, it's funny. I was in New York at the time, the first part of my pregnancy. My husband had gotten a job. I was teaching in New York. I had to finish out my school year. So we spent the first half of my pregnancy on separate coasts. And I remember talking to my therapist, getting ready to move, and saying, you know, I'm going to be moving to a new city where I don't know anybody. And my husband's going to be working, you know, 5 days a week. And I will be by myself with a new baby in a one-bedroom apartment. It sounds like a recipe for a nervous breakdown. And then I had a nervous breakdown. And so I guess I could conceive of it to that extent, but I didn't ever plan for it or really expect anything like this to happen. I'd never had any kind of mental health issues previously beyond just sort of like garden variety anxiety and depression. And not even really like that, you know, after a bad breakup, I felt pretty depressed. But otherwise, I was a pretty, you know, happy person. And this was not even on my radar.
And I guess another question, you know, while when you were experiencing it, when you were in, you know, in the middle of it, did you have a sense that things were maybe just a little not right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes people talk about psychosis and like one of the features of psychosis, meaning that you have no tie to reality, you're sort of in your own world. And that wasn't true for me. I felt like I was kind of straddling both worlds. Like I had this whole other, you know, I would take care of my baby, and my husband eventually had to like take leave from his work to take care of me. And I had family visit and help out. And so I felt like I could be in that world while at the same time there was this whole other storyline going on in my head about what was happening. And that storyline included like, I'm becoming enlightened. And my cousin, who was like one of the only other people I knew in town, who is a naturopath and kind of like was already plugged into these different ways of looking at the world that were very different from what I grew up with and we both grew up with. And I was like, well, she seems to know so much and she gets to see, you know, she understands like all of these hidden things. And I bet she's going to lead the world through a spiritual revolution. It'll be the first spiritual tradition started and run by women. And I'm going to write the sacred text. And all of this stuff was happening in my brain while I was like changing diapers and trying to make it from one therapy session to the next.
I mean, I have never given birth, but I mean, I can imagine it, I mean, what a powerful experience. I mean, but not even words just fail. Words fail when you talk about not only, you know, when the egg gets fertilized, that's a whole, but when you give birth, it's like doors open and this soul is brought into the world. It's like this strangely powerful liminal space, mm-hmm. where new life is created. It's like this threshold, you know,
the portal.
Yes. And I just think to myself, you know, maybe some women who give birth, maybe that the door gets left ajar after the baby's born.
That's how it felt.
Okay. Yeah. And it's just this, you know, kind of you start to glimpse things through the door that, you know, because you talking about just that colors were saturated or sparkly, the world was sparkly. To me, that sounds beautiful.
It was.
who wouldn't want to see the world like that all the time? But then I also think to myself, that could get overwhelming for me pretty quick. That's like too much. So maybe really our way of observation is dialed down so that we can navigate this world and not go into psychosis, not lose the tether that keeps us grounded to this reality. And I wonder if at, you know, some point in the future, they realize that some women upon giving birth, this massive threshold, this portal opens. And then for some women, it doesn't close all the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really love that metaphor. And that's really how it felt. It felt like, you know, when you open up, you open yourself up wide enough for another person to pass through, like, who knows what else comes through, you know? Yeah, it was really beautiful in a lot of ways, but it was like a bad trip, right? Like it's saturated, and in some ways it's beautiful and startling and exquisite and divine. And I can't turn it off. And my body feels like it's thrumming and vibrating all the time. And it's getting to the point where like, I can't get out of it. And I just want to make it stop. And I can't turn it off. And I can't sleep. And I feel like I'm going to be conscious all the time, 24 hours a day. And please make it stop, you know? And both of those things were true, because you can only sustain either one of those for so long.
And I'm going to suspect that this experience has completely changed your life. Would that be correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In what ways? I'm so curious.
Well, I mean, practically, it has changed my career. I always thought I would be teaching philosophy. When I moved to Portland, I figured I would be teaching maybe at a private high school, you know, or just teaching philosophy. Believe it or not, the jobs are few and far between. And I didn't want to move to like rural Minnesota to do it. I had lived in rural Minnesota before. I wasn't really interested in like doing that again. So rural Minnesota is fine and lovely in very many ways, but it just wasn't for me for the rest of my life. So I thought I would be teaching at private high school maybe. I did in the back of my mind always kind of want to do what I'm doing now, this idea of coaching, using philosophy as a means to like support and help people, but I just never really had the courage to do it. And I think the biggest thing that experience gave me was like, it's like I was living my life in this sort of channel and the bottom of it just dropped out. But at the same time, the top expanded. And so like the space just got a lot bigger. And it meant that, you know, once I had, it's like, I'd already gone crazy. Like the worst thing, I was like, what's going to happen if I try and do this thing that I was really scared to do, like put myself out into the public, try start this business, write, do a podcast, all of these things that I had wanted to do for so long, do a TED talk. I did the TED talk after all of this happened. And I don't think I ever would have had the courage to do it before. I would have felt too committed to the idea I had of myself and who I was supposed to be. But after this experience, the idea I had of myself was just blown to bits. And so it suddenly felt a lot easier to do things that didn't have to protect that image.
For listening to this episode of the podcast. There is a link to Danielle's website in the episode show notes. Please visit her site to check out this brave and formidable human being. Thank you to Danielle for being a guest and telling her powerful and poignant story. please remember, everyone, ratings and reviews and sharing the podcast is where it's at. Whatever platform you listen on, please consider taking the time to write a little review or leave a rating. And don't forget to share the podcast with everyone you meet on the street. Be shameless, be bold in sharing the podcast. You all might know that William Blake is one of my favorite authors / mystics. And in fact, the link to your beauty for this episode this week will be one of his pieces of art. But he said, in the universe, there are things that are known and things that are unknown. And in between them, there are doors. And really, we talk about that time and again on this podcast because so many of the stories that people tell involve these liminal spaces, these places between where some of us encounter doors. It makes life so much more exciting, don't you think? That doors to other mysteries and magics are all around us, if only we were able to see them? I love that thought, and that's what I'm going to carry with me this next week to kind of make the week a little more magical. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Danielle. See the potentials, the possibilities in your experiences. Yes, modern medicine can say one thing, but what is your experience? What is your feeling about the truth of what has happened in your life? Are there other ways to see it or interpret it, to encompass it and take it in? So be like Danielle and be open to the possibility of magic and mystery in not only our experiences, but also in the world. See you next week for the very next episode of this podcast. And until then, I hope your life is filled with big dreams, beautiful people, and adventures that just keep on going.
I also love this idea of talking to people about their experiences of magic and miracles, because I don't know, it's weird stuff. And
it is weird.
I think, you know, it's weird. It just is. And we in our kind of Western conception of, I mean, I think about this a lot in terms of like health and mental health in particular, you know. I went to see a lot of doctors who had a lot of ideas about, you know, how, what was happening to me and how to serve me. And I found and still find the most effective treatments to be acupuncture and things that are like a little weird and out there. And maybe that, you know, when people talk about, well, it's a placebo effect, I'm like, well, the placebo effect is still in effect. And that, like, the fact that the placebo effect works should freak all of us out. It, that to me just feels like, if you are not totally overwhelmingly freaked out and like in awe of the placebo effect, then like, what are we doing here? And I love that, like, it's just sort of like, oh, it's this thing that we, you know, it's a variable that we have to like take into account, but like, whatever, it's just part of the science, but not really a point of interest in itself. And to me, like, that is very much a point of interest.
It is interesting because, you know, this podcast is actually also about, like, I realized after I started it, how humans create meaning. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. you know, and I interviewed a woman from Japan who's like this amazing human being. And she's like, oh yeah, you know, we believe in spirits. Like, I saw spirits growing up. It's just like, so that's normal for me. And I thought, oh my gosh, most people I know here in the States would say that is not true. That's not right. Real. You're crazy or hallucinating or need mental help. But I meet more and more people like that. And I don't know if it's like an emerging, or maybe it's been around forever and just people didn't talk about it, but it seems to be people are getting more comfortable with
yes,
telling those stories. Thank goodness, right? Because we need all the help that we can get. quite frankly.
Amen. Amen. So, yes, I agree. Yeah. I mean, I'm the idea of the like Western scientific positivist way of looking at the world is like very helpful for certain things, but yeah. really unhelpful for others. It is a not a one size fits all thing. And, you know, I mean, Western medicine is really good at brain surgery, but it's really bad at like helping arthritis, yeah. you know, or allergies. And, yeah. And so I think, yeah, the way we make meaning, the different way we carve up the world, it's just a different story we tell about the world. But this, again, the stories we tell impact literally what we see and what we don't see visually. Like people who believe in spirits probably see spirits because they're looking for them. And people who don't, you know, aren't able to even be open to the possibility that that's happening. And so that they just, it doesn't happen, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been, you know, I've interviewed complete strangers like yourself, introduced through friends, but then I've also literally interviewed complete strangers and then lots of friends, of course, or friends of friends, all that stuff. And I never know what anybody's going to say, but it's always like a delight. And you know what? Plenty of people have said, you know, no, because I kind of don't believe in that stuff. And other people have said, I have too many and they're too vulnerable and raw and I just can't share them. So I've heard everything. So I'm so grateful to anyone who says yes, because I get good feedback from people. It makes their hearts happy. It makes my heart happy too. This is totally a selfish endeavor. I'm just letting you know. I'm really a terrible human being.
Well, aren't we all?
Yeah.